Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. More than 170 cities across the country have thousands of microphones embedded around town, listening for the sound of one thing, gunshots. In Columbus, city officials and police consider its gunshot detection technology, known as ShotSpotter, a vital tool, spending nearly $1 million to cover dozens of miles. But does it live up to its billing and justify the cost? Joining us now is Boston College professor of computer science, George Moeller, who has studied gunshot detection technology like ShotSpotter and Flock. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Moeller.
Thanks for having me.
So these gunshot detection systems have been in the news lately. Here in Ohio, Columbus, our city is paying about $880,000 this year to cover 13 square miles and extending its ShotSpotter contract through the year 2028. So the city uses ShotSpotter, which is from the company SoundThinking. Can you explain how the technology works? Basically, I guess we should back up and be like, what is ShotSpotter?
Yeah, so ShotSpotter installs microphones throughout the coverage area where they have a contract, and these microphones essentially listen for gunshots, and when they detect a gunshot, and that is done by a combination of an algorithm, but also they have human analysts that listen to those gunshots, and when they verify that a gunshot has occurred, then that is that alert is sent to police. They also have triangulation capabilities where if you have three sensors, they can pinpoint the location of where the shot was fired from.
And ShotSpotter comes from a company called SoundThinking. This company, is this all they do? Do they make gunshot detection technology, or is it a bigger company than that?
My understanding is it's a bigger company that has other products and software, but most of my research has focused on their gunshot detection system.
In Cleveland, the city council there is considering switching from ShotSpotter to a different gunshot detection system known as Flock. You've studied both Flock and ShotSpotter. Are they essentially the same, or do they have some differences?
Well, so we had a National Institute of Justice grant to study the ShotSpotter implementations in Kansas City and Chicago, and we studied those systems for several years. My only kind of knowledge about Flock was Indianapolis did a trial of Flock and ShotSpotter several years ago, and they asked me to conduct an analysis of that short trial period. In that trial, I will say that the number of detections that ShotSpotter found was higher than the number of alerts that the Flock system identified, and there was some differences in the kind of the accuracy of those locations as well. But Flock is relatively new compared to ShotSpotter, so I'm not aware of any randomized controlled trials or peer-reviewed publications that analyze the differences between Flock and ShotSpotter.
Okay. A recent study by Cleveland State University's Criminology Research Center found that the Cleveland Police Department shrunk its staff and had reduced, because the Cleveland Police Department's shrunken staff reduced the effectiveness of the technology. So tell me about what kind of manpower is needed to use this technology, because one would think that the technology would mean less people, but you need people to run it.
I think the resources you need are similar to what you would need to respond for citizens' calls for service that report shots fired. So, certain agencies I know that use ShotSpotter, they respond to every single alert because it's possible that there is a gunshot victim, associated with that call for service, either that's reported from a citizen or that's detected by the system. So presumably, if you didn't have enough police to respond to these shots that are detected, that would be a concern.
Do you know if they respond faster to ShotSpotter technology than people calling 911? Is that faster?
Yeah, so our research, we compare incidents that were both reported by a citizen and detected by the gunshot detection technology. And in those cases, you see the alert from ShotSpotter come in about 90 seconds on average faster than the citizen call. And this is consistent with other research that other teams have conducted. So you can see about a 1 to 2 minute increase in response time by police to gunshot detection technology. There's also other research that kind of translates that into a reduction in transport time to the hospital of gunshot victims. But you can essentially 1 to 2 minutes would be what you would see.
So you studied Chicago and Kansas City most extensively. What were some of your main findings with those cities and their use of ShotSpotter?
Yeah, so the kind of the positive of these systems is like we just discussed, that you see a time savings in responding to these shots fired and potentially gunshot victims. The system's also, at least ShotSpotter, seems fairly accurate. It can tell you where the location of that incident is. And what we saw is in certain cases that can increase collection of evidence. So in Kansas City, we found about a 30% higher, ballistic evidence at these scenes compared to control areas that we studied in Kansas City. In Chicago, gun recoveries in these areas were about 8% higher than control areas. That being said, we looked at other outcomes. For example, do these systems reduce gun violence? We did not see evidence for that. So in treatment and control areas that we studied, gun violence was not lower once ShotSpotter was deployed. Also, in terms of kind of evidence being collected, we did not see that translate into an increase in clearance rates where these shootings were solved by police in ShotSpotter treatment areas. So, if you're trying to prevent gun violence, then there may be better solutions out there than gunshot detection technology. If you're trying to just respond more quickly to these incidents, then ShotSpotter is effective at meeting that goal.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about gunshot detection technology with Boston College professor of computer science, George Moeller. So you're basically saying that it can help police get to the exact spot where the gunshot happened faster. Because I can see if someone calls 911, they'll say, "I heard a gunshot down the street," but it echoes. You don't know exactly where it's from. I mean, how accurate is this? Like, where can they triangulate you to, like, within a couple of feet to where it happened?
Yeah, in some cases that seems to be the case. So, anecdotally, I've heard from police where they have a location and right there they collect some evidence, maybe shell casings at that location. On average, we found about a distance of 235 feet between, call for service locations and gunshot where the gunshot detection system said the shots fired came from. So yeah, you can increase the accuracy of kind of where to send police by a couple hundred feet.
Do you know how cities decide where to locate the microphones?
Yeah, that's a good question. So at a kind of a higher level, these systems are placed in the neighborhoods with the highest level of gun violence, which makes sense because they're designed to kind of address a gun violence issue in a city. My understanding is, these systems, they try to put them in high, locations, and It could be on the top of a building, for example. I think the exact locations aren't disclosed to the city, but yeah, they need to cover it, put enough of them out there to triangulate these events in the areas where they're trying to cover.
I've seen some concerns raised about where they're located. You know, high crime areas, yes, that's where they need to put them. But there are also areas that are sometimes considered over-policed, with a high number of minority residents. Did that issue come up in your research with Kansas City or Chicago?
Yeah, we did do a study in Chicago comparing enforcement of police responding to gunshot detection alerts versus when citizens made a call to service for shots fired. And what we saw in those cases were the enforcement was similar. So gunshot detections didn't lead to more enforcement, for example, traffic stops or arrests, compared to what you would expect to see from a citizen call to service. And that the racial kind of makeup of those stops and arrests were similar between gunshot detection alerts and citizen calls for service. That being said, if you are sending police into an area, that does tend to increase encounters with citizens, stops, arrests. So it's kind of like a two-sided answer is it will increase those sorts of issues, but not more so than you would expect when people call in shots fired.
Columbus is spending about $880,000 to cover about 13 square miles. I don't know if that is a lot of square miles. I mean, 13 square miles doesn't sound like a lot to me. How many square miles does Kansas City and Chicago cover?
Kansas City is smaller than I think. I want to say it's 3 miles, but I'd have to look that up to get the precise number. And Chicago, I mean, that deployment covered a large percentage of the city. I think one thing about gun violence and crime is that it highly concentrates. So 50% of gun violence might occur in 5% of the city. So in that sense, in certain situations, you might be able to not cover the entire city, but cover a majority of where the gun violence occurs. I haven't looked at data from Ohio to know, that exact percentage.
And this may seem like a silly question, but anytime you hear about a microphone or a hidden microphone, there's worries about privacy. Like, can this microphone pick up, a human conversation, or is it just calibrated to hear just gunshots?
I don't know exactly how ShotSpotter works, but we've built some low-cost gunshot detectors in my lab at Boston College. And what I can tell you is you can't turn on and off the microphone. If it's off, you don't know that the alert came in. So it needs to be running continuously. And then, at least in our case, we have a machine learning algorithm that detects when a gunshot was alerted. Now, at that point, what you can do, there's privacy-preserving machine learning algorithms that will throw away anything that's not a gunshot detection. For example, a conversation. I don't know what is being done by ShotSpotter and other gunshot detection technologies, but that's kind of a decision that the engineer would make when they design these systems.
Interesting. Well, and here in Columbus, community activists want more transparency about where the devices are located. Has that come up elsewhere, or is it important? Like, is it important for them it not to be known where the microphones are?
Yeah, I'm presuming that the concern might be that if people knew where they were, they might,
Move some,
try
go somewhere
remove
else.
them. Yeah. So, and these are expensive devices, as you pointed out. So I think that would be one of the reasons that they don't disclose those locations.
So overall, do you feel like how have you seen this technology evolving? Has it become better over the years at picking up gunshots more quickly? Has ShotSpotter gotten better?
Well, Our research didn't really try to address that question. So our analysis time period was 2012 to 2019. And what I can say is it seemed to be pretty accurate at doing what it claimed to do, detecting gunshots during that time period. I think that the question might be more is how can this cost be brought down? Because this ShotSpotter has been around for decades at this point. And there is this component where human analysts are kind of in the loop to make these decisions. I think maybe you'll see in the future that AI can bring down and the cost of the hardware could maybe come down to the point where maybe we don't have to make these trade-off decisions of do we invest in gunshot detection technology or do we invest in violence interruption workers, community groups, hotspot policing, or other alternative ways to try to reduce gun violence.
We've been listening to Boston College computer science professor George Moeller. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk with a local company that is all in on AI, helping to train and educate others. That's when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. There can no longer be any doubt that AI is the future. From the classroom to the workplace, artificial intelligence is being implemented in every aspect of the way we work. With AI leading to so much change, new forms of education are needed so that we can keep up and successfully utilize this new technology. AI-AL is an artificial intelligence training program that focuses on the human side of AI, with a goal of providing education about AI so that it can be harnessed to reach its full potential. We're talking today with Cass Maxwell, CEO of AI-AL. Welcome to All Sides, Cass.
Hello.
And we're also in the studio with us. We have AI-AL's president, Trace Johnson. Welcome to All Sides, Trace.
Hi there.
So, Cass, let's start with you. Can you give us a quick description of what services AIL provides and who they're geared toward? Basically, like an overview of AIL.
Yeah, I think Trace and I, we were talking about this. I think we're going to take a tag team approach on this.
Yeah. Sure.
Trace is going to take the high and I'm going to take the low. So,
oh, great. Well, let's start with the high.
Yeah, let's do the high first.
Sure. So I think we can all basically agree that we're a tool utilizing group of people. When we see a stick, we say, hey, can I throw that to my dog? Or can I burn it for fire? Or is it in my way? Or what else can I do with this? Can I use it to hike? All these different things. So that to say, we look at objects and we fundamentally place them as some sort of tool for us. And one of the big problems with AI right now is that there's a lot of noise in the space. It's very cluttered, very confusing. We're not exactly sure how to use it as a tool. Right. So I think AIL as a business, one of the things that we do is focus on, we had this old tool belt. We called it Microsoft Word, Excel, an internet browser, this, that, and
I'm
the other.
Familiar. Yeah.
Those are our old, technological tool belts, right? Now we have some emerging technologies where we essentially have to rebuild how we get work done with this brand new technology and slot these things into our tool belt in a different way.
Okay, so then, Cass, that was the high view.
Yes.
So more on the ground, what services do you provide?
Yeah, so, obviously HiVue helping society adopt this. And then the way we do that is, we go into a business, we'll spend 8 to 10 hours with that business, and we're taking them from demystification to integration. So what is AI, what is it not, all the way to, how can I actually integrate this into my workflow and keep it human-centered, obviously, because that's the big buzzword right now, is it going to take my job, right? And so, our goal is to put the human in the center of it, figure out what maybe they don't want to do, and have AI, automate that and build solutions around that.
And you're working with companies, individuals, educators. I mean, it runs the gamut, right?
Yeah, we're working, nonprofits, for-profits, government entities, you know, K-12, higher ed, you know, we're working with. If you work with technology, we're probably working with you.
And then, Trace, the companies, they hire you to come up with, to teach them, or are you creating an AI policy? Are you doing both?
Yeah, we'll certainly do that. I mean, one of the things that we find is that we have to have a cultural change within the organization to collectively wrap our heads around what is it we're going to do with this, right? And as people begin to utilize the tools, which is most important, get your hands on them, actually use them for something beneficial and something that you self-select, which helps with the, it's going to take my job if you in fact self-select what, you know, maybe you don't want to do that the technology can. But through the process of actually utilizing it, putting it to work and having it work for you, it's really easy to develop your own best processes, best practices, and ideas and how it actually fits into a policy.
And I do need to back up about the company name, AI Owl. Does Owl have a meaning? Does OWL stand for something, or where did Owl come from?
It does. It's optimized workforce learning.
Okay.
Then we did adopt the owl as our mascot, of course. So
optimized workforce learning is something that's been around, and you just decided to lean into the owl thing.
Yeah, definitely.
All right.
You got to have a mascot, right?
Am I the only one that has trouble saying, though, AI owl?
No, not at all. AI owl. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
All right. Trace, can we talk about the impact so far? I mean, what sort of impact have you seen your company seeing? You know, as AI develops, more people need more help. Can you tell me an impact story?
Oh, for sure. One of the interesting things, so first of all, I think that we can consider this a revolution, but the reason is because it's really the first time that everybody can interact with a computer using their words, mm-hmm. right? It wasn't always the case. You know, I'm an engineer. That's my background. I knew how to interact with a computer, but it was through code and understanding, you know, how microprocessors work. But now we can interact with it just using our words. And what this has fundamentally done is filled an experience gap. A couple of years ago, I couldn't ask a 17-year-old intern to reformat an invoice because the first question they would have is, what's an invoice,
right?
Of course, they can, you know, chat with an LLM and say, hey, my boss just told me that I need to reformat an invoice. Where do I start? And what are the, you know, maybe 10 steps I need to do in order to follow that? And so we found this experience gap that's able to be filled in younger people, older people. I mean, people who have fundamentally lost time, mm-hmm. right, and are ready for upskilling in their career. And so what that's done is, look, we're the AI experts, not the subject matter experts. We weren't in the field for 25 years doing whatever it is that that person does. But a collaborative framework with the AI allows them to do really incredible things. And so I'll tell you a story about some young people who are doing really incredible things. I mean, they're out at Tip City High School, and they're in Ridgewood High School out in Coshocton. And what they're fundamentally doing is solving problems that are around them. Now, when you're in school, the problems that you get exposed to are probably from your teachers or educators. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, third grade reading is a big problem that the educators are all aware of. And so they told the students in one of our AIPC labs, hey, we have this problem where third graders, you know, are working on vocab lists and things like that. And the process, you know, it's probably lacking. I'm wondering if you in the AI lab can develop something that could help third graders do a better job reading. And they developed on their own a software in collaboration with the AI where the teacher inputs their vocab list, and then the student, third grade student, chats with the AI basically like an ad-lib story, right?
Oh.
An ad-lib story where they build a story together and the AI stops at a certain point, and based on what the teacher had put in the vocab list, the student has to fill that in, and then the story continues. But of course, the story is different every time and it's tailored to the student's, you know, wants and desires and interest and things like that. And so they build the story in a very fun way while still at the same time learning something. So that's been a really cool thing to watch a group of high school girls get in a lab and utilize this technology collaboratively to solve a problem.
That's great. And it's high schoolers working with elementary school kids in a very unique way.
Exactly.
Yep.
And Cass, you mentioned earlier that AI, you know, there's that fear that AI is coming for our jobs. Do you hear that from a lot of people? I mean, I feel like it's a valid fear for some people to have. How do you help, you know, say it's important to learn about this? You don't have to be afraid of it.
I would say that it is the number one fear that we hear when we're out there. You know, that is, when we enter an organization, there's usually so much resistance from X group of people, right? So maybe it's the guy in the back that, you know, wants nothing to do with AI. And what happens, though, is that, you know, the first part of our training is pure demystification, right? So we're working with you, you know, simple tools, helping you understand that this is not the Terminator, right? And this is how you integrate this. And you'll find that just through that simple, you know, couple hours of spending with the person, that their guard goes completely down. Mm-hmm. They start to see the value within it. And they're way more willing to bring it in then. And usually those people that are the most resistant become the most raving fans of mm-hmm. the technology, which is a interesting thing to see as well. So, and another phenomenon we always see is that when we go in and we're working with these tools and we're helping people understand, is that they give you the stuff they don't want to do, right? Mm. They give you the admin, the stuff that they have to get off work and clean up really quick at home. And so we're finding they give you what they don't want to do. And I think what you're going to see in the future is that you're going to be able to now focus on your passion, not the minute task and the stuff that's busy work. You're going to be able to focus on your passion, which is going to make the workplace more productive, which, you know, is hopefully going to give you a happier life. So I think that's the true power of the roadmap that AI is going to put people on. Will there be some displacement? Of course. But I think with just the growing technology within there and other emerging technologies, just like we've seen in the past, we're going to free up time to find more ways to fill that time.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about AI training and education with AI Owls President Trace Johnson and AI Owls CEO Cass Maxwell. Well, and what he was just saying, Trace, relates to what you said earlier about the invoice. So it's the idea that, yes, AI can take someone's job. A person doesn't need to sit down and make an invoice anymore because we can just ask the computer to do it. But now that human has the opportunity to do something else, do something more creative. Is that the way to look at it?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. We're under a model of self-selection, or you could say problem solving, right? Mm-hmm. So focusing on solving problems fundamentally and asking people what their problems are, they're giving us the things that they don't want to do, which by definition is not the things that they don't find valuable about themselves and about the work that they do or the value that they can contribute to their workplace, world, society, whatever it may be. It's the scraps, if you will, right? And that's a great thing for the AI to be able to do, is pick up the scraps, clean them up. And I'll tell you another story too. This was really cool because we were working with the Columbus Zoo, and the zookeepers told us, you know, again, look, I got this job to spend time with the coolest animals on the planet. That's why I got this job. But as it turns out, now I'm watching a lot of videos and filling out metric health report forms after watching the videos. How long were they in the sun? How long did they play? How long did they eat? Where did they spend time in the enclosure? Mm-hmm. Did they drink enough? All this good stuff. And so we said, well, we think we can help with that. We think we can build a vision system that just watches the animals and fills out these metrics, and then you can, you know, determine whether or not those are accurate or not as the human check at the very end. And so this project is another thing where self-selected to improve the quality of work life and basically fulfill a dream, which is I want to spend more time with the coolest animals on the planet, not fill out health reports.
Oh, when you say a vision system, so it's like mm-hmm. the cameras that are there, you have AI analyze it.
Correct.
For like when the animal eats, when the animal sleeps, and then the human just checks it at the end?
Yeah, exactly. And the vision systems are already really sophisticated. I always tell people, you know, if you want to get started with AI, take a picture of your refrigerator and ask what you can make for dinner tonight, you know, just as a fun game. And it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Yeah. Cass, what about the idea of ethical concerns? How does your company navigate this idea of using AI responsibly? There's a lot of mm-hmm. issues with worries about ethics.
Of course. So anybody we put through, you know, we have an ethics module, number one. So, you know, when you go through the 8 to 10 hours of training that we have, the last hour or two of that is purely ethics. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about how the LLM's made, how it makes decisions. You know, how those things can affect your workplace, you know, information to not to put in it, and basically a very holistic approach on, you know, this is how you should think about it ethically. And we even have some ethics games that we play with autonomous vehicles and AI and things like that within class as well. So it's definitely a large part of what we do, just making sure that it is being deployed in a way that society is going to look at favorably.
I've been told in past shows that we've done about AI that AI can solve problems, answer questions, but it doesn't know how to read context clues. Do you agree with that analysis, where AI doesn't understand, like, that's that human thing right?
Do you know what I mean? I've seen that. I mean, a lot of the issue with the context clues is, though, like if we had this conversation for the past few minutes as we had, and then we decided to invoke AI, well, it wasn't around for the rest of the conversation, mm-hmm. right? So we're just invoking it at a moment in time, and it's very difficult for it to have that particular context. I think that when the context is available to it, but that's based on how a user actually uses it, it does a pretty darn good job. It's just all about, you know, how much information it has.
You have to teach the user how to ask the question properly. Is that...
Well, yeah, and give it the right amount of information so that you're not pulling it in blind to a situation, if you will, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm.
Your company is based out of Ohio. Is Ohio an AI training ground? How does Ohio fit into the bigger picture? Because you think of all of this stuff happening, you know, in California, but how's Ohio doing when it comes to the future of AI?
I think it's super bright. Mm-hmm. I always say that we stand on the shoulders of giants here in Ohio. We've had a lot of great, not only institutions of education, but educational policy that puts us ahead in terms of, and I love this because it's fairly agrarian, going back to our Ohio roots of planting this technology in the ground and growing it, right? We may not be able to have the VC resources and some of those things that California has in order to generate this technology. We're not as risky, I think. Mm-hmm. But when something does come out that has the opportunity to change the way we live, we're doing a really great job of integrating that into educational systems based on the policies we have and the opportunities we have and doing something with it.
Mm. You'd be surprised how many people are... willing to bring it in. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, when we first started this a couple of years ago, we thought there was going to be a huge amount of resistance. And we actually started in Appalachia, you know, Southeast Ohio, and it permeated like crazy. And I mean, people were just so welcome to bring it in when we thought it was going to be the complete opposite. So I don't know if that says something about Ohio, but
yeah, I think it might. You know.
There are worries about desocialization, especially with mm-hmm. kids interacting with it. You know, the idea, you know, the difference between asking a computer to help you format an essay versus having a friend help you. Yeah. Where do you find the balance in that?
Yeah, that's a large issue as well. I mean, I think AI has its place in communication with students. You know, I think it can collect that data, aggregate that data. And be able to provide a certain amount of clarity, whether that be a parent, whether it be a guidance counselor on, you know, what that student is thinking, how they're interacting, and maybe, you know, how to place that person in a job or a major. But yeah, there's definitely a tipping point to where it's like, okay, maybe I need to get my kid off the iPad, you know,
yeah.
like we're talking about, you know, currently right now and all of that. So I don't necessarily have the clearest answer on that, mm-hmm. but I mean, there's a place for it. And I think it's going to come down to probably to individual on, you know, how it's deployed.
I learned about something new by looking at your website. You're working with Ohio Tech Cred. That's a state program, right? I had mm-hmm. never heard about that. Can you tell me about that, Trace?
Sure. It's a really incredible opportunity for training providers and companies and then their employees in the state of Ohio to have the ability to have training reimbursed, right? Mm-hmm. So these are for tech-focused credentials that employers select. And then if they meet the eligibility requirements of the program, they can be reimbursed, you know, up to 100%, depending on the cost of the training for that. So this is one of those policy, I call it a real technology integration lubricant, right? Mm. It really allows for the way to get technology infused into companies really quickly, because what we found is that it didn't really matter how great your high school education was or your college education was 5-10 years down the road. Well, are you going back to college? Maybe not. Maybe you have a family. Mm. Maybe other things are going on in your life, right? You're maybe not going to go back into college. So how are you getting the information when technology is changing so rapidly? Mm. That particular program, the TechCred program, allows for this almost, you could say, lifelong learning process to occur. It's really mm-hmm. special. Mm-hmm.
Another thing I learned about that I had not heard of from your website is that, Trace, you were appointed to the Executive Order of the Ohio Commodores from Governor DeWine for your innovative work. Tell me about that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's a pleasure. So that was a namesake of Commodore Perry, who, of course, mm-hmm. won the Battle of Lake Erie in the War of 1812.
Of course.
Of
okay.
course. Yeah, of course. But it was, I believe, set up by Governor Rhodes to essentially... I think recognition to those who are focused on economic development and the betterment of the state. And I hope every day I'm working hard to fulfill that requirement.
Congratulations on being a Commodore.
Yeah, thank you.
It's
thank
a cool,
you.
I mean, it's a cool name at least, right?
It's fun.
Well, we are out of time, but I want to thank you so much for your time. Thank you to AI Owl's president, Trace Johnson. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
And AI Owl's CEO, Cass Maxwell. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And coming up, we're going to talk a little more about tech with our resident tech guru, Russell Hawley, who will be back with his holiday gift guide. That is when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Yesterday was Cyber Monday, and we just lived through another Black Friday. There's no denying that tech gear tops many holiday lists. Plus, a desire to save, and save big, is driving sales during these in-store and online promotions. Our resident tech expert is Russell Hawley and is a valuable resource each week, but perhaps even more so during this time of year, because he's back with his annual holiday gift guide, helping us make sense of the dizzying array of tech offerings out there. And today he's going to focus on some surefire tech picks for the adult on your list. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
And Russell is the Director of Commerce Content at CNET. I missed your title there. So first off, what is your assessment of Black Friday and Cyber Monday? Is it too early to gauge whether we saw big sales from tech retailers out there?
It's a little too early to gauge how successful those results were, but it's undeniable that every retailer, you know, really tried their best to get some really interesting deals in front of people. With that came a lot of things that were not exactly deals, and a lot of that is aided by tariffs. You could see several things that, you know, were really popular earlier this year had increased quite a bit in price, such that even when there was a Black Friday discount to it, it wasn't quite as discounted as it would have been, say, in July. But, you know, that doesn't mean that there was nothing that was worth picking up. But yeah, there were it was certainly a different tone this year. So we'll see what the results are.
So one Cyber Monday deal that you highlighted is called Govee Smart TV? Okay, Govee Smart TV backlight. And these are LED backlights, and they adjust in real time to the TV content playing on your screen. And I am very intrigued to categorize this as something I didn't know I needed.
These are so much fun. I've used these for a while now, and I recommend them to anyone who has a TV that is near a wall, because you kind of need that in order for that to be a thing. Bonus points if it is mounted directly on the wall. But the way that this works is it uses a pair of cameras to gather, you know, all of the information that's currently happening on your screen, and it makes sure that all of the LED pixels that you have mounted behind the television light up in synchronization with whatever the colors currently are on the screen. So it takes the image that you're looking at on the screen, it doesn't matter if it's a video game or a movie or a TV show, it takes it and it extends it across the wall for, you know, another couple inches in a way that when you've got the lights down and a good sound bar, it is the closest thing to feeling like you're in a theater. I really enjoy these.
Yeah. So there's an app with it and it has multiple modes. And there's even a holiday party mode. Can you describe what some of the different modes look like?
Yeah, so you can have these, you know, if you've got folks over and you're not watching something, you know, you can have a screensaver of choice on, or you can just have these set to, you know, rotate through an array of colors. The holiday mode is really kind of interesting because it allows you to turn on a microphone that is not normally on. And if you've got holiday music playing, really any kind of music playing, it will take that and it will make sure that the LED pixels on the light dance in synchronization with the music that you're listening to.
Oh, that's fun. Does this work with all TVs, or are there brand or size compatibility things we need to worry about?
This will work with any television that you can connect it to the back to, but there are different versions of this light depending on the size of your television. So you need more LEDs if you have something that is bigger than a 65-inch television, for example. So they have one that is for 65 to 75 inches, and they have one for 55 to 65 inches, and so on. It's within that kind of 10-inch space that you pick the size that you need. Setup is really easy. There's a bunch of adhesives and a pretty quick set of instructions that you can go through within the app, and it usually takes about 15 minutes.
I read a review, and the reviewer said to take the time at the beginning to white balance it, because then the colors work better. Tell me, what does that mean?
Yeah, so every TV is a little different when it comes to the kind of colors that they produce. It doesn't matter if it's made by Samsung or LG, they all say that they're the best, and the color, toning is something that is proprietary to those companies. So what you want to do first is just make sure that the camera system understands what this television's version of flat white is, and it can use that to make sure that the color that it produces is the same.
So that same reviewer said that the first time they used it, they were watching a James Bond movie, and the opening scene had a lot of blood in it, and the TV lights turned his whole room red, and he fell in love with the product. that sounds a little gory, but also very cool. Is that what you, why you recommend
it's a
this?
Lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, any movie that you can think of that has, moments of really bright, intense color, you will appreciate more with these lights, I have found.
I'm thinking it would also make a horror movie a little more terrifying as the colors in the room change for you.
Not just a horror movie, yeah. But anytime there's a dark scene with like a thunderclap.
Oh.
And that like flash of lightning, you'll get that, basically throughout your room to go with it in a way that's really kind of intense.
All right. So Amazon showed these at $74. This was a Cyber Monday deal, half the regular price. So is that a good price for this?
This is a great price for these, and it is actually still available at that price right now.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about some tech gifts with CNET's Director of Commerce Content, Russell Hawley. Another gift on your list, this would be for an adult, is the Sonos Roam 2. It's a portable, waterproof Bluetooth speaker. The description says it produces size-defying clarity and bass. So tell me about why you like this Bluetooth speaker.
Sonos speakers are widely considered some of the best that you can have in your home as far as their actual sound quality. And one of the things that a lot of Sonos users over the time have really wanted is something that was a little more portable so they could take it wherever they are and not sacrifice much in the way of quality. That ends up being really difficult to do. And there are tons of portable speakers that exist right now, across the world. So being able to stand out in that way is challenging. The first version of the Sonos Roam did not do this. It was not something that got recommended a whole lot, but the second version really is kind of an elevated portable speaker. So if you are someone who values that, kind of audio quality and wants something that you can, take outside or, have sit by the pool and not be a permanent fixture, this is something that I would recommend to you.
Describe to us the size of it. Like, what would you compare it to? How big is it?
Oh, this is really interesting. It is smaller than a can of Pringles.
Okay.
In terms, it's probably about 2/3 of the height of that when standing up, and it's in kind of an interesting triangular shape, with kind of smoothed corners.
So you're saying it has, size-defying clarity. So basically, the sound coming out of the speaker is just something you would expect needing a much bigger speaker to produce.
Yeah, if you've ever used, kind of mid-range $80 or so Bluetooth speaker outside, that when you hit the volume all the way to its maximum so that you can hear it from across the yard or something like that, the sound just gets muddy. Mm. You can still hear it, but it's not, the cleanest sound ever. This is something that Sonos is historically quite good at, where it is a company that got its start making speakers for televisions and for, like home theater systems and things like that, as well as, whole sound systems for like your entire home where you can have speakers in every room of the house and have them all synced up. So being able to do something loud is something this company has quite a bit of experience with.
And did I mention that it's waterproof? Like how waterproof?
This is not, it is waterproof, but it's not something that you should toss into a pool. You know, if it gets splashed, or if it gets hit by a hose or something like that, there's very little chance of any problems. But if you decide that it's a good idea to have it on a little floating board and push it out into the middle of your pool so that you can reach it when you need it, you're probably asking for a bad time.
And then it also has kind of, I think it's good battery life. There's 10 hours of listening time. So that can get you through 5 days worth of All Sides shows in one charge. so is that a good amount of charge for a Bluetooth speaker?
It's a little lower than what you would consider the average, which makes sense given the additional power necessary for the volume that this speaker is capable of. This is something that, you know, you're not taking, you know, for maybe a multi-day hiking trip like you would other Bluetooth speakers. But this is absolutely something that if you wanted to be outside for a day, that it would be, you know, more than capable of handling that. And the battery life varies depending on what your volume is. So if you plan on having it, maybe it's, you know, 30% of its maximum volume or something like that, you'll get a few more hours out of it.
And then the Cyber Monday price was $139, with the regular price being $179. Is that a good deal, $139?
$139 is great. I think it's actually currently at $145 at Best Buy, which would make it still quite a bit cheaper than its regular price.
And the final question about it, it has a multi-room audio with it. So can it connect with other speakers too? Or what does that mean, multi-room?
Specifically other Sonos speakers. So if you have other Sonos speakers in your house or more than one Sonos room, then you can pair them together and get a greater effect there. Hmm.
Moving on to another product, this is a drawing robot for kids. So this is a kids pick that you included for us today. The drawing robot incorporates Montessori principles, and it's called, is it Rivgot? Is that right?
Rivgot. Okay.
Rivgot. So tell me about this little robot. He's cute. His name's Rivgot.
So what Rivgot does is... Rivgot comes with, this is a little difficult to explain. Rivgot comes with a whole collection of cards that have drawings on them. And what you do is you take that drawing, maybe it's a cupcake or a rainbow or something quite simple designed for kids, you know, 8 and under. And you put the card on the top of Rivgot, and it scans a special barcode that is on it. And the robot will then go and teach the child how to draw that thing in its most basic terms. So it'll say, you know, step one is to draw the shape, and it will draw it with the child. The idea is for the two of you to draw side by side, where the robot will draw the shape and then it will wait for you to do the same. The robot is not smart enough to like look down and say, hey, that's correct, you did a good job, or anything like that. It really, you know, is something that is an example only, meant for an adult to be there with the kid while this is being used.
And I would describe it as, it looks a little bit like a tiny version of Eva from WALL-E, right?
It definitely has some familiar design to it. You've got two little glowing eyes, and it's a very, plain white robot that holds a marker, and that's just about all it does.
Do you know what it means whenever it says it incorporates Montessori principles?
The Montessori painting principles is what it refers to, and that is the step-by-step process in order to complete the drawing. So, you know, there is a fundamental art style there, and that you start with some of the smaller shapes, and then you build a frame around it, is my understanding.
So I watched a video of a child drawing along with the robot. Now, it says the robot draws... a perfect drawing, but is there any worry, you know, that a kid might be worried that they can't replicate the robot's drawing perfectly? It looked like fun to draw with a robot, but also maybe my drawing wouldn't be perfect like the robot's.
This is very much why I would recommend there be a parent involved in when this is happening, because, you know, sure, the robot is going to draw a perfect version of that, but we should definitely not, as a society, be comparing ourselves to robots.
Right. My son likes to watch how to draw videos on YouTube, but I can see the appeal of having, like, a little robot buddy sitting next to you while you're drawing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What do you know?
Extra points if you manage to get, like, a Bob Ross, like, wig on him.
Yeah, that would be cute. What do you know what ages this little robot's targeted to?
This is currently ages 8 and under what this is targeted to.
All right. So the Cyber Monday price of this robot was $59. I mean, that seems like a good price.
Absolutely, yeah. And it comes with 150 art projects for the robot to do with your kid, and they can always be done more than once.
We have just a minute left, but you added a little thing in here that says a family bonus that you think people should get as a gift, the dropstick game, which I've seen videos of, and it's super fun. Tell me why you think people should get the dropstick game.
Exactly for what you just suggested, right? Like this is something that has become quite viral, this dropstick game. It is really simple. There is, a vertical rod and six horizontal rods, the other way around, apologize. And it will drop them one at a time as kind of a hand-eye coordination game. And it's really fun to do with family as kind of a competitive thing. I have had friends that have done this as, kind of a joke, and then 2 hours later they were still doing it because it is a really great, simple, and honestly pretty inexpensive way to have a kind of competitive family moment.
Yes, and if you're looking for a little icebreaker at your holiday gathering and you're like, let's not talk politics. Let's go play this really fun and hard game.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And if you are frustrated by, things that require quite a bit of hand-eye coordination, maybe this is not the way to start. But if you enjoy some simple competitive gaming with friends and family, then yeah, this can be a lot of fun.
All right. Dropstick Game is our final recommendation for today. Russell Hawley will be back next week with more holiday gift ideas. Russell Hawley is the Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks so much, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurovich.
Stretch of Houston. A Hindu temple, Vietnamese Buddhist center, a church, and a mosque all call each other neighbor.
That's what the United States is. We're a melting pot of a whole lot of different nationalities and different religions, etc. And I think that this is just a microcosm of that.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How the Union Corridor presents a snapshot of inter-